Are you someone who has talents within you, inside you, that you're desperate to share with the rest of the world? Or are you someone who cares about the world and what you put into it? Well, The Good Hustle might be the book that you need to read. It's a guide to creating a heart-centered business, which we'll find out what that is in a moment. And it's a new book by the terrific Dr. Polly McGee. Polly's with us in the studio now. So if you'd like to call and ask any questions, please do. 1-300-222-936. That's 1-300-222-936. Even if you'd just like to ask Polly how she's been, since she's not been on our radio waves quite as much. Polly, thanks for coming in tonight.
Hello, Melanie Tate. It's so lovely to be here.
It's so great to be F2F, face-to-face with you tonight.
Yeah.
It really is.
All the way.
Now, how have you been over the last, how long has it been since we haven't had you on the radio? It's been about a year.
No, you know, it's been more. It's been a couple of years because it's been at least a couple of years because I started writing The Good Hustle after after I left, and well and truly that's been 18 months at least in from conception to birth. So, yeah, wow. I looked back the other day and everything sort of seems to have slipped into a giant vacuum as it does, but it's been too long, radio listeners.
Absolutely too long. Well, let's go back in time. Now, before we do anything else, I'd love you to share with us the kind of eclectic life that you've had in terms of your professional life in getting to this point to write this book, like the kinds of things you've tried out before you found, you know, your purpose that's within this book.
I should have got that question from you earlier because there's a passage in the book where I actually list my professions,
which
great. I could find for you if you have a copy there.
I do, and I'm just trying to find it now.
So it's a lot, and the genesis for the book was very much this sense that I had spent so much of my life trying to find the thing that I was meant to do, and it was very much a thing. And I always really envied all those children I knew at school that knew exactly what they wanted to do, and my husband, who knew from pretty much birth that he wanted to be an engineer. And I just felt this incredible sense of frustration, bordering on rage at times, about how I just didn't know. So I think I just started out to try everything in the sense that it would fit. And I kind of make the analogy that it was like I was rummaging through a sales bin and I was trying on every career I could, and I'd put it on and go, yep, this is the one, it's really comfortable. And then, you know, within weeks I'd be like, this just doesn't fit me. And I'd be sort of back to this slump of like, oh. But let me read you this passage because it was one, in fact, in this whole book, the editing process for this was quite divine and I had the greatest editor of all. And the only passage that she was like, I'm not sure we need this. And I'm like, we're keeping this one. There was one paragraph I kept and this was it.
Well, you know, and how quickly did I find it? Because I remembered it so clearly.
And it was really important because I just wanted people to know that I wasn't sort of just some kind of whinging first world problem. So in the book I say, just in case you thought I was some kind of quitter, here's a selection of the jobs I have wholeheartedly thrown myself into since launching my adult life of finding my Dharma. And we'll talk about Dharma in a minute. Chef, hairdresser, sandwich hand, commercial shop fitter, window dresser, fashion retailer, call center agent, cafe owner, adult film reviewer, political lobbyist, digital strategist, farmhand, artist in residence, radio presenter, public servant, speechwriter, innovation grants manager, IP manager, not-for-profit co-founder, copywriter, web builder, academic, author, yoga teacher, social media trainer, strategic marketing lead, and I can also now add director of corporate affairs to that.
Can we go back another time and just do a whole separate interview on being an adult film reviewer?
We sure can.
Great.
I think we've already had that interview when you first started, Melanie Tate.
So
that is a story in itself, though.
Great. So you have been, you've really tried with all of your guts a whole heap of things. Now, what was it that you were searching for or that wasn't satisfied by that list of things?
I think what I was searching for was contentment. I was searching for a sense that I actually was doing the thing that I should be doing. And it's such a nebulous concept, but it's a body feeling for me. And I could feel when it wasn't right. And I'd really, really try, but it's like, you know, it'd be like when you're in a relationship and you know that it's not right, but you also don't know what other options you've got. So you sort of stay in it, but then you stay in it to the point where you think this is actually going to be damaging. And yes, for me, I sort of had quite a fast fail kind of policy, and I would get to a point and I think, okay, no, this just isn't working and I'm not going to make it work. I got to recognize the signs, and then I'd make sure everything was tidied and there was a good succession plan in place, and then I'd go. And I also recognize now, looking back, that my modus of working is very much as an agent of change. And I do tend to go in and I do make change. I'm a disruptor. I fix stuff up and then I'm kind of done. And it's the same, I guess, with my world of startup work. I'm really big in the ideation to market part, but I'm not an operational person. I don't want to stay in the same place doing the same thing. So in lots of ways, that life completely prepared me for everything, because what it did was it exposed me to so many different types of people. It gave me a lot of different experiences. It put me in a lot of really kind of high risk and bizarre circumstances, which, of course, are great fodder for any writer. Mm-hmm. And in many of those experiences and people really inhabit a lot of my writing. But it allowed me to just to have this smorgasbord of people, which then kind of got me to the place where I realized that the thing I really loved was people, and was understanding people, and was seeing people who were really happy and content. And then I realized that my own contentment was actually just about being someone who could to shine that light for others. And it's been a long road to a really probably quite straightforward ending.
Polly, what are these? Because this is I think this is such an interesting conversation to have, because I know of so many people who are within jobs themselves that are feeling unsatisfied, or feeling, particularly somewhere like Tasmania that is just full of makers and creative people. And, you know, everybody has a job back, but it does something else on the, you know, I think I've got a friend, for example, who is, he has a certain job, but he's also an amazing baker, and he also makes these amazing coffee things. I can't quite describe what, but you know, like a really talented person. So I feel like a lot of people have these things ready to go. How did you know? You said that the signs became, you got signs that things weren't for you, that they became obvious. What sort of signs were they? What kind of things would happen to you bodily? Because indeed, you said this was a bodily thing.
I think it is physical, because clearly I was intellectually able to talk myself down and convince myself out of the things that I felt I should be doing. And in the end, it was really the circuitousness to that was that I sort of took myself off and sort of spent 2 months doing yoga, which I did not long after I left the ABC. So I went to a yoga ashram and I spent 2 months embedded in this ashram learning to become a yoga teacher. But auspiciously, I wanted to just plonk my butt down and try and work out what all this churning was about and you know, would I find the answer to it. So the bodily thing for me is this. It's almost like there's a rise. You get up in the morning and you physically don't want to go into work. You get there and your heart sinks, and it's very hard to sort of pull yourself out of that. And you just kind of feel, and the converse of that is that when you are in that thing that you should be doing, you feel yourself rise, and you feel every part of your body sort of become engaged and electric, and you feel like your heart expands. And it's the only way I can describe it. It is for me, it's a very physical experience, but I also think it is for other people, because the one thing I learned sort of after talking to people and starting to write the book, and particularly now it's come out, and I'm getting so many people contacting me that they're all like, you wrote this for me. This was exactly my story. This is exactly how I've been feeling. And part of it is that I believe from when we're children, we spend so much time being kind of groomed into what we should be doing for all the reasons of mortgages and education and what a good and sort of proper career for a, you know, first world Western child is, that the things we know as children that we have that bodily reaction to, where we really feel that's what we want, we kind of ignore them and put them to one side, and our parents and carers might sort of dissuade us from it. And I remember, so in my brother's case, he always wanted to be a musician, and he was told very clearly as a young child that that wasn't the career for him. He'd never make money as a musician and he'd never be able to be a creative. And he, to his credit, just completely denied that and just has spent his whole life creating and doing what he wanted. Yes, he's been incredibly poor and he's lived that life, but he's chosen that and he really chooses it. And he doesn't have interest in those trappings and assets, because what he wants to do is this one thing he wanted to do, which is create music, and that's all he does. So I think that the capacity to listen and to trust and follow those instincts, and that's not an easy path. And I think that the point of it is that sometimes it involves great hardship and great sacrifice. And I suppose yoga as a holistic philosophy gives us the tools to deal with that sacrifice and to deal with those austerities, which is why when I sort of, you know, the story of how I got to the ashram in itself was very much about when I started going, I'm just following my gut all the time now. It's kind of like the dice man for my gut.
All right. So, yeah, tell me about your gut saying you had to go to an ashram for 2 months. That's pretty full on stuff.
Yeah. And it's really interesting. So I spent a year when I was in one of these situations where I'd had this recognition that it wasn't for me. And instead of sort of doing my fast fail, I said, okay, well, what would happen if instead of just getting out and trying the next outfit career on, I just stayed and said, okay, what can I do that will make this right? And so I'd been reading a lot of spiritual texts. I'd been reading a lot of yogic philosophy. It really interests me. So I was drawn to that, I guess, rather than any other thing I could have been reading. And looking for, you know, I decided I should do what the book said and look within. So I thought, how do I do that? And I thought, what about if I just go to work every single day and I try to be present to what I'm doing and I try to be the best person I can to the people around me. What if my whole mission in this job was to deliver what I was there to do, but was also to just be incredibly kind and to see people and to recognize them for who they were. And that sort of just became my mission. So I started being really gut-led at that point and I was really honing into that. So when I finished that work, I'd sort of had a contract. I was going to finish it up. I was determined to stay to the end and I got this very clear sort of inner message, and that sounds very woo-woo, I know, but it was this sort of feeling that was kind of like I was driving along one day and I just got this intense body feeling that I was finished. And I kind of was thinking in my thinking head, how can I be finished? I'm not finished till the end of the contract. And I just sort of just knew that the next thing that came along, I had to take it. And, you know, lo and behold, I got a call from a friend of mine who said, look, we've got this piece of consulting for you with fantastic money in it. I knew it was enough to allow me to intellectually leave a paid job and mm-hmm. not do anything. So I did that, and then that had given me enough income to sort of spend some time sitting and thinking. I was going to go overseas and do some work in India and go and do some volunteering with a kids' school because, you know, yogis do that stuff. And then it was near New Year's Eve and I was just tooling around on Facebook and, you know, long story short, this ad popped up for a two-month immersion to learn yoga, and I just instantly knew I had to do it. And I sat on it for a couple of days because I was kind of thinking, maybe you've just gone a bit crazy and you keep on presenting these bizarre situations to my, you know, poor but long-suffering loving husband. So I went to him and said, look, how would you feel about me doing this for 8 weeks? Because I was going to be in India for a while and blah, blah. He said, that sounds great. You should just do it. You know, and this is the joy of having the unwavering support of someone who truly loves you. And I just thought, okay, I don't know why. I don't know anything about it. And I'm just going to roll the dice and I'm going to go. And I just went and did it. And because I was there and because I was studying all this really intense yogic philosophy and because I had such a history of working with startups and teaching entrepreneurs and writing programs for startups, I had this great connection of going, oh, the entrepreneurial life, it's just like the path to enlightenment and all the renunciation and all the austerities these yogis did. It's what entrepreneurs do when they single-focusedly point themselves towards achieving something. And I don't know about you, but every entrepreneur that I've met isn't doing it to make the money. They're doing something because they're driven by something that is so tangible, so much bigger than they are, that they can't put it down. It's gnawing at them and they have to fulfill it. And I was thinking, you know, I wonder if I can make this work together as a book. And I kept on thinking about it and I couldn't put it down. And so that piece of grit became a pearl.
A pearl called The Good Hustle, which we're talking with Polly McGee about on the radio. Now, if you've just joined us, we've actually got a talkback caller. Andrea has called in from Hobart. Hello, Andrea.
Hello. How are you, lady?
Well, thanks. How are you?
I'm very good.
Good. Now, what did you want to ask, Andrea?
I was inspired, Polly, just in the first few sentences, hearing what your book was about and a little bit about your journey was an appetizer. And it just happened to be I was coming back from a board meeting. I was thinking and inspired about the foster carers that work for us, caring for children, and also staff who put their heart and soul into everything they do every day. And the rise that I get is my heart does rise when I see good things happening for kids that come into state care. But I wanted to hear more, and I probably would be quite happy now to just sit and listen to the conversation you two are having, because it's inspiring, and it will help my journey, I'm sure. And you just gave me the vital answer, which was the title to your book. So I'll remember now. But what is it that keeps the heart in an organisation that has heart, do you think?
Look, Andrea, I suppose for me, one of the things behind the book was that I had met many, many women predominantly who had gone into doing what I see as good hustles, like really working with groups that had a deep need for them, but often were in organisations that either they had sort of set up and they had a needy user group that didn't fund them, so they had to get funding from an external source. You would be really familiar with that in the world that you're in. And we're constantly chasing dollars and very, very stressed and very frustrated and really unable to sort of connect on a really heart level at the delivery point of what they were doing. So part of the book is really about how to set up a business so it's robust and sustainable so you can be in that place where you're giving service. But given that a lot of your people are already there, the thing for me is that you remember constantly who you're in service to. And this was the real flip for me around talking about business as a way to create revenue. Good hustles, by their nature, are driven by asking the question of who am I in service to and who am I called to be in service to. And then everything becomes about enabling and enriching the life of that other. Not at the detriment of yourself, because the self has to be strong. Unless you are strong and able to give, you can't really fully be in service. But it's always remembering, you know, when the funding's low and when everything's stressed and when you're seeing all this pain out there, yeah. A, that you can't, also you can't control the pain and you can't control what's happened in, you know, in foster sense to those kids. What you can control is the kindness and the compassion and the empathy that you bring, the space you create to hear and see people and their stories and be with them and meet them in their pain. And I think that's where the good hustle really works.
That's awesome. It's inspiring. I'm going to race out and grab a book. We turn 150 next year, and I often say to people, we're still here because families in Tassie still need us. Yeah. Thank you so much for your inspiring story, and I want to let you get back because I want to hear more.
Andrea, thank you so much for calling.
And thank you for the work you and all of those amazing foster carers do.
Andrea, you're from Kennelly, aren't you? Because you just turned 120. Congratulations. And
150,
did you say? Crikey.
150.
My goodness.
Andrea, can you stay on the line and talk to the producer and give me an address? I'd like to send you guys a copy of the book to have in the office so you can all dip in. I'm really just so grateful for the work you do.
So moved. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Andrea.
Very generous, Polly. Good night, ladies.
Good night. Thank you.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye. Bye. And if you'd like to call 1300 222 936, that's 1300 222 936. If you want to call in like Andrea, let's talk then about, let's move on to heart-centered. You know, this is for heart-centered business. What makes something heart-centered? I mean, can you make a bank heart-centered?
Yeah, absolutely. And when we were doing the book launch the other night, someone came up to me afterwards and said, oh, I really wanted to ask if you can make politics heart-centered because, you know, with the election coming up. And everything can be heart-centered.
Politics should be heart-centered in actual fact.
Anything politics should be heart-centered. But, of course, a bank should be heart-centered. Mm-hmm. And heart-centered is really about the locus of everything you do being from a place of love and compassion as against being from a thinking place and an intellectual place and a place that's dissociated with the real experience of people. So I often, you know, see businesses that have got their values emblazoned up on the wall, you know, and we do this and we do that. And then I see people who are miserable, who are really struggling in cultures that aren't supporting them, that aren't recognizing them, that are causing a lot of stress. And there's a great difference to being heart-centered in word and heart-centered in deed. And it really is about truly valuing the individual, mm-hmm. recognizing the difference. All the things that we hear a lot, there's a lot of sort of rhetoric that goes on about this, particularly in corporations, but it is really doing something that is for the greater good. And so for me, heart-centered in an agile sort of entrepreneurial small business sense is a business that is directed at solving from sort of big wicked problems to the problems of communities to a problem that whatever your solution is going to make it better for someone. Now, that can be baking a perfect loaf of sourdough. That can also be finding a solution to women who are in abused situations or foster kids. It doesn't really mm-hmm. matter. And in a bank sense, if you think about what those transactions do and the people on the other end of those transactions, there is a lot of heart that could be going into that. So everything, when it's about the person or the group you're in service to, mm-hmm. is heart-centered, because it's not about you. It's about the other and bringing that other person in and recognizing that you can actively make change. And I feel like the key point here is that the change can be very small. I think a lot of people don't do the things that they're really drawn to. And let's have a conversation about Dharma mm-hmm. and what that means, because I think a lot of these kind of Sanskrit-y spiritual words can be a real barrier for people. But this idea that you can actually do something that is really small that has a profound impact. Mm-hmm. And people don't do things because they think that they need to solve all the problems. And mm-hmm. they don't. They actually just need to solve one tiny problem for one person. And that can be the greatest thing possible.
Well, let's talk about Dharma itself. What exactly is Dharma? What does it mean? And if you're not a Buddhist, can you still practice Dharma in your life?
So Dharma is the way that both Hinduism and Buddhism expresses this idea, and they do it slightly differently. So I'm giving you an opinion here. This isn't a generalised discourse on those religions and philosophies, which I know about one millimetre of. But Dharma is the sense in Hinduism that it is the thing that you are born to do. So in your reincarnated body, you're here to deliver one thing. In Buddhism, it's a subtle difference of it being more that you are behaving in a way that is right body, right mind, and right spirit, so that you are working in your dharma, which is in you are kind of doing the right thing. And it's not just working; it's everything you do is living against the precepts of causing no harm. So Buddha had a set of precepts for which we can live by, which serve as a moral compass. Now, in the yogic world, where a lot of the teachings of yoga come from, and you know, yoga, I think for many of us, is just the postures you see people doing in a yoga class. But yoga is it's a philosophy, and it's a series of actions that lead to enlightenment. And again, like lots of words, which are kind of, oh God, they're so big, but
big ideas too. Yeah. I mean, enlightenment just seems so far away from anybody who's ever heard the word.
And this was the other part of my project, I guess, with The Good Hustle, which was to say there is some really beautiful words and philosophies that have been written that we don't discredit them, but they're written of a time, of an age, of a situation, which is not the time and age that we're in right now. So how could I take these very dense, very complex philosophies and make them something that any of us can pick up and say, okay, so how do we do this? So if you sit down and read Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, it's a massive volume of incredibly complex religious and spiritual philosophy. But the basic precepts of it are an eight-limbed path to enlightenment. So very much my project was let's make this simple. How do we apply this to our life right now? And so for me, if I talk about enlightenment, it's not sort of going into cloud in the sky somewhere and it all being incredible. It's actually the sense that you are completely content all the time, and that you are feeling you are where you're meant to be, and that you are unruffled by the things that go around you, that you can feel love and equanimity for everyone, not just for the people that are like you and are kind to you and don't cut you off in the traffic.
So a lack of, I would imagine, resentment and jealousy and coveting other people's things, etc.
Yeah, and that you've released the attachments to those sort of that rough sea of emotions. And so very much that work takes lifetimes. And so why it's so important in yoga is because the antidote to that are the stages of yoga, which include not just doing the asana practice or the postures, but deep meditation, concentration, getting right within yourself, you know, having a moral compass about what you do so you're not causing harm to others and you're not being excessively greedy and attached to sense pleasures, that you're able to start relinquishing those things. And that takes time and it takes practice.
Polly McGee, how do you apply that to your work life? I mean, if you think about, you mentioned before that there's that feeling of going into work and feeling a bit ill and not really wanting to be there. I would venture to say a great percentage of Australians experience that every day, but they have families and mortgages and things like that that they believe tie them to these jobs. Yeah. How do you begin to, you know, for somebody listening to us that you know, may not have a whole heap of skills that they can just move out of their job or get a big contract to be able to, you know, have some space? What are the steps that somebody can take to begin their own good hustle, like to get into their own, to not feel ill about going into work or not be sitting resenting, checking Facebook all day or the like?
Well, the good news is that I thought about that a lot because I'm really conscious that people can't make those choices for a whole heap of reasons. And so for me, the good hustle, you know, the good hustle is a Trojan horse. It's auspiciously a book about business, but really it's a book about finding happiness within oneself. So all of the good hustle begins in the mind. For me, everything begins in the mind because it's in the mind that we create the misery. It's in the mind that we create the bodily reaction. It's in the mind that all of this happens. So really a lot of the good hustle is actually talking about ways that we can start to make friends with ourselves and becoming friends with ourselves. And I heard a beautiful interview with Pema Chodron, who's a Buddhist nun and writer, who's a really a beautiful teacher to me and many others. And she was saying that, you know, when people talk about making friends with themselves, they're like, well, but I've got all those sort of feelings of resentment, all these things I don't like about myself. And what she said is, you know, when you've got good friends, friends that you really love, that have been with you for a long time, they see all of you. They see your pettiness. They see your greatness. They see all the things that you abhor. And they still love you. And so making friends with yourself is about integrating those things that you're full of shame about, that you want to crush down and put away, and bring them into the light of you and saying, holistically, you are this person and that you are all of those things and that none of them are good or bad. They just are. So once you start going through that process, and again, this is where the Yoga Sutras really work, because the Yoga Sutras teach us how to do this. It's really straightforward. They teach us in a way which isn't sort of religious and dogmatic. They teach us in a way of saying, this is how you can apply this to every part of your life, no matter who you are, whether you're sweeping in the street or whether you're a yogi in a cave or whether you're the king. You know, everyone could live by this. So in answer to your question, it's sort of exactly, I guess, the process that I unconsciously did, which was going in and saying, how do I get through a full day by being kind? How do I keep my mouth shut when I want to come out with a snarky comment? If I'm sitting
with all big stuff, actually, isn't it?
It is big stuff. You know, and if I'm sitting at the desk of an employer and I'm on Facebook all day, well, I'm stealing because I'm not being paid to do that. So if I'm using my moral compass and I know that stuff isn't right, and that's one of the Yoga Sutras, is not doing these kind of actions. So then I park that because I know that I should be focusing on the job that's at hand. And then finding ways, for me in the workplace, it's finding ways that you can actually do your good hustle. So you talk about the side hustles that so many of us have. So I think there's lots of opportunities to start connecting with the people around you in the workplace. And if I think about my time spent in lots of different places in Australia in the public sector, where you often find people who are sort of unhappy, but they've got what they call the golden handcuffs. You know, we did some really creative things. We started craft markets. We started food stalls to raise money. We started cooking competitions. We did yoga. We did all these different things where people would come up and say, hey, I've got these skills. I could do this too.
So this is suddenly a side hustle.
This is, you know, but this is in a workplace. So you haven't had to leave the workplace. So you're what I'd call an intrapreneur in lots of ways, in that you're getting to do that thing that makes you feel more closely connected with what you're here to do. At the same time, you're not sitting in that cubicle or in your train, you know, cabin or in your bus or wherever it is that you are, that you're not happy and contented. You're starting to look outside of you and your isolation. And one of the great things that happens in the West with our wealth and with our educations and with all of our social media is that we've become really isolated. And in separating from other people, we're alone. And when we're alone, we've got our backs against the wall and we don't know what's coming at us next. When we step out of there and sort of say, okay, I'm going to make the assumption that everyone really is like me. We all wake up in the morning and we're all suffering. We're all in samsara. We are all attached to all of our stuff. And so if you're all like me, then we're more the same than we're different. Mm-hmm. And rather than sort of going on and like the look of your face, or, you know, you cut me off in traffic or you didn't sign off on that paper, you kind of go, okay, so what can I do to make things less suffering for you? And maybe we find this bridge where we both have a common interest, or we can do something together, and suddenly we're side by side and suddenly we don't feel quite so isolated. Mm-hmm. And hope comes there. Hope sits in that place.
We are so fast running out of time, would you believe it? I want to ask you, though.
I don't believe it.
We've talked yoga and Buddhism. If you're not a spiritual person, if you're not a yogic person, is this book still something that is for you?
Yeah, absolutely. And I say that not because I'm looking to maximize sales. I say that because Buddhism particularly asks people to be skeptical. The teachings of Buddha, the very, very early teachings of Buddha, he said, you know, my teaching should be approached the same way that you approach gold. You should get it and you should work it and work it and work it and find all the flaws in it and see if it really is gold. And, you know, make sure that you've got all of the impurities out of it, because I've got an opinion. And Buddhism and a lot of, I mean, really every religious philosophy it's a set of rules to be applied, if you want to call them that. But particularly in the way that I look at yoga has never been designed to be dogmatic. Yoga is a set of ways of being. And you can take them or leave them. We can take the word yoga and Buddhism and sort of all that philosophy out of it if that doesn't sit with you, because it doesn't need to. And what I found really interesting is that I had an idea of a very specific market that would buy this book. There were kind of people like me that sort of had an interest in that kind of stuff. What's been really great is the number of people who have sort of gone, oh, my wife bought this and I picked it up, couldn't put it down, or people that I thought were very far away from that stuff who have read it and they haven't needed that. They haven't needed to take that from it. What they've taken from it was the validation of how they felt, was the reflection of the things that had been going on in their head and in their bodies, that they had then suddenly found that it wasn't just them, and they'd made this point of connection. And there's been a lot of feedback to me from people I thought, wowzers, I never, ever thought that. In fact, a guy who came to the Sydney launch came up to me afterwards and said, look, I just came to support my wife and she wanted to see you. And he said, I never, ever considered reading a book. And he said, I'm going to read it cover to cover and I cannot wait because this is exactly what I've been looking for. And so it's that stuff where I think there's one of my very favourite writers, Elizabeth Gilbert, who I know you love as well. She talks about when she first wrote Eat, Pray, Love, that people would write to her and say, and you know how in that book you said this, and so I just went and did that and it changed my life. And she'd think, I did not ever write that thing about you should leave your husband or you should do this or you should do that. But people read in the books the words they need to hear. And I think that the greatest gift as a writer is to be able to have a very loose grip on the you in the words and to just feel that you are putting something out there that is going to give someone the answer. And that answer isn't your answer, that's their answer, and they read that in those pages. And so I believe this book is for everyone, and the people that need it will come across it. They'll see it, it'll jump into their hands and they won't know why, or someone will give them a copy of it and they will know that this is the one they're looking for. And there's probably 100 other books that are going to have that experience for a million other people, and that's a beautiful thing.